This rip of TFTC was brought to you by River. It's the best place to buy Bitcoin. Go to river.com/TFTC and enjoy this episode.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Chris, thank you for joining us here.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Like I was saying, I met your partner, Omid, earlier this year. He gave a great speech on this panel at the Young Global Leaders event hosted by Scott Atlas in Palm Beach. And I became a big fan of 1789 Capital, what you guys are doing, almost immediately, because I think what you're doing is very important. Fading ESG and leading in to EIG or EGI?
EIG.
EIG.
Entrepreneurship, yes. Innovation, and growth.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's desperately needed right now. I've been fighting so in Bitcoin, I'm in the Bitcoin mining industry, helped start a Bitcoin mining company. We're doing off-grid oil and gas flare mitigation on upstream well pads in the Bakken. And so I got introduced to the ESG fight pretty early in like 2018, 2019, where they really came at the Bitcoin mining industry for using too much energy and the wrong energy too. Using natural gas or reliable energy sources is something that most people don't like these days.
Yeah, I mean, look, ESG is like the innovation destroying industry. It's literally just using the major financial institutions in this country in order to kill innovation. It's like, it's completely absurd. And, you know, I think, like, I'm sort of optimistic, might be overstating, but like maybe cautiously optimistic that people are starting to figure out nobody has made money on their ESG investments. In fact, nobody's not lost money. Everybody's losing money on their ESG investments, and yet those mandates are still out there. They're in all kinds of fund documents. They're in the documents that asset managers have to live by. And yet the dirty secret is they don't work. And by the way, losing money is the best thing that ESG does. It's like if you're an asset manager, you invest $1 billion in ESG, you might lose 5% a year. You know, 5 years, you're going to lose 25-30% or something. That's the best thing you just did with that money. Actually, the second order effects are worse than the first order effects, because the misallocation of capital, it's the opportunity costs associated with that misallocation is really huge, right? It incentivizes all kinds of bad, destructive behavior, and it stifles actual innovation. The only way that we have any sort of sustainable prosperity in this country is if we continue to innovate.
Yeah. Now, you can't virtue signal your way to returns, which...
No, you can't virtue signal your way to returns. You can't virtue signal your way to increase productivity, and you can't virtue signal your way to increased national or individual wealth. Try as people might.
Yeah. Well, it seems, have we become a nation of virtue signaling? Obviously, the returns for ESG have been bad. And the concept of the vibe shift has been big, particularly in conservative circles. And I would argue that it seems like people are starting to wake up, especially as the pain of price inflation begins to weigh on everybody, particularly the middle and lower class. It seems like people are throwing their hands up. But with that in mind, like, it feels like in the U.S. over the last two decades, we've been a bit complacent. And you see BRICS countries making a big move, particularly post-Russia, U.S. Treasury freeze. Seems like we're at a massive inflection point, and particularly at the federal government level, the U.S. seems to be sleeping at the wheel.
Again, I kind of feel like the same thing with ESG. I wish they were asleep at the wheel. That'd be an improvement. Like, it's like the Hippocratic Oath: first, do no harm. Like, we got to get them back. That's neutral, right? We have to get them back to where they stop actively doing harm. You know, just to pick up on something you said a second ago, you're like, sort of like conservatives have figured out that ESG is a scam and a harmful scam at that. That's true. That's true. But I actually, you know, I was at this dinner with President Trump a couple weeks ago, and he made this kind of side comment, as he does when, you know, he gets up there and he riffs. You know, if you talk about the president, by the way, you have to. It's obligatory. It's obligatory impersonation. It's too fun not to do. But he says, you know, like, no girls in women's sports, like, secure borders, sound money, more jobs. He says conservative. Just sounds normal to me.
Yeah,
that's it. Like, there's some part of me that thinks. I mean, I'm a conservative, happy to say it, but there's a bunch of this stuff that doesn't or shouldn't have like a political ideological valence. Like, if you want to have like low crime rates and stable money and like lack of inflation, like is that like an ideological position now? I don't think most people think about that. So I just always wonder when we're thinking about these things and like these stark right left terms, it's true that it's associated with people who have a particular political point of view, but there's also a bunch of sort of apolitical people like, I don't know, I think maybe it would be a good idea if people could get good paying jobs and we had industry in this country. Like, so I don't know. I've just been thinking about that a bunch since the president made that like totally a side comment. I'm like, yeah, that actually makes sense. That's just like basic American normal person values.
Yeah. Well, it's like the meme going around Twitter. I think it resurfaced. I think it went around a couple of years ago too, but it has like the spectrum, the political spectrum on a line. It's very short. It's
yeah.
Like somebody's left of center, and then everybody on the left just ran all the way to the left side of the page. And
yeah.
If you were left of center 10 years ago, you're now a neo-Nazi in the U.S.
There's another sort of form of that. What I just saw, it's like it's kind of has this like it's a distribution graph. It kind of goes like this. So people listening on audio can't see that, but there's like 10%. It's like left, and there's like another 5% that's like moderate, and then it shows like this huge distribution. It says far right.
That is the most disconcerting thing for me is that everything has become hyper-partisan. Hyper-polarized, or at least the media and conversational social media a lot of times has become vitriolic and hyper-partisan. And I think it's because we've been boxed into this frame, particularly with four-year election cycles and the drama around the last two elections, specifically three elections, really, if we go back to 2016, maybe you can argue even earlier. But this focus on this four-year election cycle, which has caught people sort of in this whipsaw of going from one extreme to the other over the last 8 years, and looks like we're going to do that again potentially this year. It just seems really discombobulating where we're over-indexing on the government to solve our problems, where I think a lot of effort, that's why we focus on Bitcoin here, and I view Bitcoin as this external apolitical network that we can use to build our way out of the problems that the political class doesn't seem either capable or willing to solve themselves.
Yeah, both.
Yeah.
Not capable, not willing.
This episode was presented by River. River is the best, most secure place to buy Bitcoin in the United States. Go to river.com/TFTC, set up an account today. You'll be able to DCA into Bitcoin without paying any fees. You'll be able to give people Bitcoin via River links. You'll be able to send and receive Bitcoin over the Lightning Network. And you'll be able to set limit orders. If you want to buy Bitcoin at a particular price below or above where it is now, you can set orders to buy Bitcoin when it hits that price. Go to river.com/TFTC and set up your account today. This trip was also brought to you by our good friends at Unchained. Unchained is building a financial services platform for a Bitcoin standard. They have over 7,000 clients that are securing over 90,000 Bitcoin with 12,000 keys on their platform. Their platform leverages Bitcoin's native multi-sig properties. Their cornerstone product is their Vault product, a 2 of 3 multi-sig Vault, which allows you to hold 2 of 3 keys in a multi-sig quorum. That gives you full control over your Bitcoin. They also have an IRA product, a lending desk, and their rolling out a bunch of other products, including an inheritance protocol and sound advisory. So go to unchained.com, set up a call with their concierge onboarding team today, tell them that TFTC sent you, and use the promo code TFTC at checkout. Unchained.com.
Tell a story on that point, which just goes to your point. And like, I remember when I, the first, So I bought a tiny amount of Bitcoin back in the day, like other people. It's like, why didn't I like sell everything I had, right? You know, but so I wouldn't even count. It was such a small amount. It was like, it doesn't even count. Okay. So the first actual meaningful transaction in crypto that I made was in 2017 in ETH. And my bet at that time was a very simple bet, which was there's actually a lot of really smart people working in crypto broadly, Bitcoin. And then, you know, ETH was relatively new at the time. And it was just a bet on the people and the talent and the people who actually had a really big vision for what was possible. And I thought, I don't know, like if you put, like, it wasn't like betting like my entire financial future on, but it was a meaningful bet on it. And it was bet on basically vision plus talent plus energy equals something good. I didn't know what the something good was going to be, but that seemed like a decent bet for, and it was a bet at the time, but it, which worked out well. And I still think that same thing, which is that you have, if we have a big vision for the future that we want, like the phrase I use a lot is we have to, and this is like a phrase we use in a, I use it in a political context, I use it in a business sort of tech context too, which is we have to build the country we want to live in. And Bitcoin is undoubtedly a big part of that, because it is trying to actually have a positive vision of the future and what it is you want to achieve. And it's building a tool to try and achieve that. Like, it's, and this is one of the frustrating things for people who aren't, you know, sort of brain damaged to spend much time in politics, by the way, which is a tiny amount of those people, which is, it's frustrating because nobody actually knows what they want. Like, they speak in slogans. Like, if, like, kind of at a first approximation, people on the left talk about justice and people on the right talk about freedom, but generally don't have a lot below that. Now, I would say actually the left has a much more substantial constructive vision or destructive vision. Or in other words, they have concrete things they want to achieve. But people on the right sort of want to be left alone.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, why can't we just, like, I can't, like, it's kind of like, I feel like there's like a deer in the headlights moment that's been going on for like 120 years on the right. It's like, what do you mean they want to do fill in the blank, whatever this like crazy thing is? What do you mean they want to do X? You know, I can't believe that. Like, why do we have to fight this fight? But you do. And that's actually my one sort of constructive critique of sort of the, like the, I don't know if you, and it's probably not like a Bitcoin maxi position, but like the position that like it can be unpolitical, because all, there's a way to understand politics and human life, which is everything has some element of politics. It's just choices. Good and bad. How do you want to live? And there, and I would say Bitcoin is an instantiation of a positive vision of life. But it does have. It's not purely neutral, and I think we should understand it as not being purely neutral, as being something that is gives people the power, hopefully, to be left alone. I think it's not a silver bullet. It's not an orange bullet either, but it's a bullet, and a powerful one if we're able to continue building on the achievements that have occurred so far.
Yeah. When I say Bitcoin is apolitical, like the network itself, the protocol is apolitical, where it has no idea,
right?
But the implementation,
the vision behind it, yeah. Right? And the implementation, I think, is where
the implementation of the scarce monetary system seeped in Austrian theory. That's definitely a political divergence from the Keynesian neoliberal model that we've been living under for decades. But to your point, actually, I'm happy they brought up vision, because I released an episode last week with a gentleman named Matthew Pines, who works in DC and is basically a political strategist. And that was the one thing I asked him towards the end of the episode, is what do we need to do to get out of this morass in the United States? Because it seems like I mentioned earlier, BRICS countries are beginning to basically form their own coalition and really paint a good vision of the future, whether we agree with the different leaders and countries and their governance structures. It is undeniable that UAE, Emirates, the Emirates, Saudi, Iran, even to an extent, they're really seeing that the U.S. is becoming complacent. They're making a land grab for talent and capital and resources, particularly as it pertains to energy and AI. And that's the one thing I said, like, I can see, because we've seen it Just in the fund space within Bitcoin with 2022, 2023, pretty terrible years for venture. A lot of the institutional capital was over indexed to private equity, so they weren't giving off a bunch of capital to funds that were raising new funds, and so everybody went over to the Middle East, and it's a lot of money there, and they're willing to give it out, and you have massive funds raised. And Matt's basically prognosis of what's going on is like, yes, they're giving all this money to American venture capitalists because they want inside information on what's going on in terms of like innovative technologies that are being built here. And I asked him what the solution to that was. He said, we need long-term vision. We can't go back and forth ping-ponging from election to election without any decade, multi-decade long vision. And so in your mind, what would the vision that you would put forth?
Fortunately, I came prepared for that answer because I wrote a book on the subject. Yeah. So it's I think that let me just start with like an anecdote of how I arrived at this answer first, because I wrote this book that came out last year. It's called America and the Art of the Possible. And I've told the story a couple times, but I wrote the first draft of the book was like 400 pages. And it was one really long complaint of everything that was wrong. And it was like sort of cathartic to get it out. I started writing it during COVID. And when I got to the end of it, I just felt like such a loser for writing it. I'm like, you just spent like a self-indulgent, like 400 pages doing nothing but complaining. And it was like, that's like just not helpful. It may actually literally be helpful in selling books because people love like books that, doom porn. I'm like, but no, that's not satisfying at all. And so I basically scrapped about probably 80% of it and thought, well, okay, like what I said, in that first draft, I think it's true. Like those, like these criticisms of things that are going and have gone wrong, I think is right. But that's only can be the predicate. Right, you have to have a diagnosis, and then you have to have some type of a therapeutic, and so that became effectively in a slightly different form the first half of the book. And I thought, well, if you think all of these things are going wrong, what would it look like if it was going right? And so, and just my business background, you know, it's always you tend to, in some one way or another, you tend to think of these things almost like an engineering problem, like what is it we want? Where do we want to go? What is it we want to have? And then you can build the tools or the infrastructure to get there. And so that's when I said, okay, well, we got to make our goals really concrete, which is that's where this phrase came from that I said a minute ago, which is build the country you want to live in. Right. Well, let's like make super simple things. Like what would be what's the good life? So, you know, number one, you should be able in this country to live basically a family life, an ordinary family life, husband, wife, two kids, own a house, own a car, have healthcare, have education, just basic, like what you kind of think of as like classic middle American dream type of life, not extravagant, but like a totally decent life, where you also own some assets, you know, car or whatever, and house. And you should be able to do that on a single median wage. The last time that was possible in this country was 1989. It had been possible basically throughout the post-World War II era until 1989, and then it slowly got worse and worse and worse. And now, and it's been this way for like the past maybe 5 or 6 years, there's not a single MSA in the top 25 MSAs in this country where you could afford to buy the median-priced home in that MSA on a single median wage. So, well, that's a problem. So that's one thing. We should have, as a nation, we should have a fertility rate that's at least at break even. Mm-hmm. So about 2.1, we're at about 1.65, 1.7.
That's not good.
There's something strange about that, just as a side note here. And by the way, this is happening all over the world. Like fertility rates are falling every place and have been for decades. There are countries that are still, not many, but there are countries that are still above replacement. But you look at places like even in sub-Saharan Africa or in places in the Middle East where like 15, 20 years ago, fertility was like 8 children per woman, which is a lot, you know, and they're now at like maybe 3.5. And then you've got places like South Korea, which South Korea is like, by, you know, last person out, turn off the lights. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, their fertility rate is less than half of the replacement rate. So they're in like or demographic collapse. So you should be able to at least replace your population. Should have a like lifespan that's growing. Mm-hmm. Lifespan in the United States has been declining for like 10 years. So it was, and by the way, here's a weird stat, but true. All of our peer countries in the OECD, say take France as an example, their longevity is increasing in the same time period where the United States longevity lifespan has been decreasing.
Fallen materially too, I believe, because I tweeted about this, it had to be like 6 months ago at this point, and I didn't believe it when I saw the stat and I had to go fact check. And I was like, holy shit, I think it fell from like 76 to 72.
I think we peaked around 80 or 81, mm-hmm. and now we're down in the mid 70s.
Yeah.
And declining, by the way. It's like, mm-hmm. it's been just consistently down. Meanwhile, increasing in like Western Europe. Fun fact is that lifespan in France continues to rise while our lifespan continues to decrease. About 35% of all Frenchmen are daily smokers. I don't know. You do the math.
Life was better before the smoking ban.
exactly. but here's the other thing, because I've thrown that out there. Like, I don't know. I'm pro nicotine, but like I'm sort of neutral on smoking.
As well.
Yeah, adds 10 points of IQ maybe for temporarily. I know lots of people who might want to double up on the nicotine or triple up. The other part of it is not just longevity. It's what some people started calling health span, which is a term I really like. Just book Outlive, another mm-hmm. Austinite, Peter Attia, mm-hmm. wrote. I think he may have actually coined the term. It's a great term. Basically, it's meant to encapsulate not just how long you live, but how healthy you are during your life. And so, yeah, it's great to live to 100, but like not if you like. Theoretically, you could be on life support from 60 to 100, and that wouldn't be great. But like the incidence of all of the sort of four horsemen diseases, you know, cancer, Alzheimer's, diabetes, and arthritis, you know, they continue to increase in this country. And so, what does it look like? Well, you should be living longer, and you should be living healthier. Like, and then, you know, you should be secure in yourself. Like, there should be low crime. Your border should be secure of the country. And people, you know, all in all, when you think about, like, what does the country look like that we want to live in? It's one that is cohesive. So we have the capacity for collective action. Like, if we wanted to put a man on the moon again, like, mm-hmm. we could come together and say, like, this is an important national priority, and we could do it. And the baseline for that is, or the foundation for all that, is, I think, all these other things. Right, you have to have a society that's stable, that is sustainable, that is prosperous, and then you have the predicate to do great things. Mm-hmm. And so we have to have I consider baseline stability. It's somewhat unusual in human history. That's like one of the things that's made America so great and so unique. It's not the only time it's happened. It's happened in other times and places, but like, you know, a lot of human history is just history of like savagery, death, mm-hmm. and misery, right? And we need to really fight to encourage and make sure that we have a sustainable country that's able to produce that type of, you know, peace and prosperity for additional generations. And then, as I say, then you can do the big things, mm-hmm. right? And those are, I said this at the end of the book, unclear what those are, right? We can't do them now. Like, I don't think we have the capacity to do them. And we need to at least get back to having the capacity to do them.
Yeah. Quick break here, freaks. This rip is brought to you by Gradually Then Suddenly, a framework for understanding Bitcoin as money by Parker Lewis. I wrote the foreword to the book. I'm honored to have done so because it's the best 0-to-1 primer if you're looking for a logical explanation of why Bitcoin obsoletes all other money. Buy one for yourself and maybe a few for your friends. Go to thesafehouse.com/gradually. That's thesafehouse.com, safe spelled SAIF, thesafehouse.com/gradually. Use the promo code TFTC for $5 off at checkout. Buy it now, freaks. The price of Bitcoin is going up. You need to understand it. This is the best 0-to-1 primer. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Zaprite. If you're a Bitcoiner and run a business or an independent contractor, you should be accepting Bitcoin as payment. If not you, then who? If we believe that fiat is systemically fragile and is a risk, the rails that that currency runs on are a risk as well. You need to begin accepting Bitcoin as soon as possible. Invest in the future of your business. Create a redundant rail by accepting Bitcoin as payment using Zaprite and reduce risk for your business. I've done this for my business. Here at TFTC, we use Zaprite. It allows you to easily create invoices, payment links, or connect e-commerce stores, connect your wallets or custodial accounts, and be set up in minutes. We can also connect our bank accounts, our Stripe accounts, or Square accounts to accept fiat as well. The time is now, freaks. The fiat system is fragile. Invest in the infrastructure that de-risks the future. Invest in yourself. Bitcoin payments with Zaprite. Go to Zaprite.com/TFTC to get $40 off their annual subscription. Zaprite.com/TFTC. $40 off. I think it all stems from the money. That's what we have out here. Fix the money. Fix the world. Because going back to like single income households, like if you look at the trend, like the site WTF happened in 1971.
Yeah.
.com. It's when you lay it out like that, it's like, yeah, it makes sense because you have both parents in the workforce. They're not able to focus on their kids. Maybe they'd be able to give them a better education or be more nurturing to create better psychoanalytic state for these children. Mm-hmm. They're all gypped up on Adderall. Since we've gone off the gold standard, quality of food has gone down because you have the CPI substitution where it's like they want people to notice that the price of a ribeye or ground beef's going up. So I'm going to switch out the soy slop into the CPI, and kids are eating all this hyper-processed food, which is leading to diabetes, heart disease, arthritis, all of that. And we're just like a nation that is on the hamster wheel. And so you have both parents in the workforce, barely making enough money to survive for the people in the middle and lower classes. Their kids are being indoctrinated in public schools. Mm-hmm. They're eating shit. They're not getting outside. And you look up a generation, two generations later, it's like, holy shit, we've got massive health problems, obesity problems, wealth inequality problems, just quality of life problems all around.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, going back to misallocation of capital,
right,
the fact that we can print all this money and then it bleeds in other areas. Like energy is something I'm very focused on. Like we should be spinning up all the nuclear power plants that we can. We should be spinning up natural gas and coal plants as well. But the misallocation of capital, particularly from renewable energy credits, is really perturbing the pricing signal in energy markets, which is mm-hmm. leading to less reliable grids. I mean, we have experiences here in Texas in the last couple of years. Like we have massive expansion of capacity, but that capacity is unreliable, wind and solar, at times when you need it most desperately. Particularly in the middle of winter and middle of summer. Apparently, it gets a lot hotter in the summer because the wind doesn't blow, and so you don't have that wind generation. The sun goes down every day.
What? Breaking news.
And it just blows my mind that we've gotten to this point where even in Texas, we've allowed this misallocation of capital to seep in and really corrupt the market.
Like the electric car thing is a complete, regardless of what you think about it, I mean, like it doesn't work in trucking, for instance. Like, no. Sorry, everybody, but it's like physics is still real. I see you had, where is it? You had Atlas Shrugged up here someplace, A equals A, mm-hmm. right? It still does. You know, electric cars, I don't know, they've got to probably have an appropriate place in the mix of the national fleet. It is a complete and utter pipe dream with the amount of, electrical generation capacity that we have in the country right now. Like, this isn't like higher mathematics. This is arithmetic. How much power generation do we need versus how much do we produce? And we don't produce near enough for the goals that the folks in Washington seem to have stated for just electric cars alone. So there's like those ends don't meet. And you know, they're not going to start meeting because you throw a bunch of wind farms out on the Texas prairie either.
No, it's funny. I saw, again, referencing Twitter, I feel like I'm doing that a lot this episode, but somebody tweeted out, they did a road trip from Florida up through New York over to Chicago, down back to Florida. And they were presenting the stats. And I think it was, they would have had if they were filling up a car with gas, that car would have to get 30 miles per gallon to be commensurate. So he's like, presenting it as cheaper than a gas car. But then one of the stat lines was like time weighted charging car. It was like 11 hours on the trip. Where it's like, if you're just filling up gas, it would have been 20 minutes collectively.
Right.
And like, you're not factoring the value lost in that time you waited for your car to charge. And then on top of that, you think of if we went to a full EV fleet before we even get to like the electrical infrastructure, it's like, just think of the logistics of people having to wait 15, 30 minutes to charge their car.
And God help us if Apple ever made an electric car, they change the fucking charger every on every model, and you'd have to buy a new charger every 5 minutes. Yeah.
It's like we've reached a point in this country where politicians are able to say, yes, we're going net zero by 2030. And they present it as something incredible and virtuous and something that we should strive for. And then like you spend 5 minutes thinking about second and third order effects. It's like, this doesn't make any sense at all. And that's what worries me about where we are today.
I'm full of these anecdotes, but you know, on the political class, I've got a very good friend who's been a super successful investor, like really smart guy, like good guy. Like he's like, you think about the person you're always thinking, why don't people like this? Why don't they run for office? God, we need people like this. He's that guy. Okay. Mm-hmm. Family guy, like, you know, just everything good is about this guy. So he, a couple of years ago, he was thinking about running for Congress, and, what he would have won in the district, he could self-fund. It was a Republican district, et cetera, et cetera. And ultimately comes to the conclusion he's not going to do it. And the single biggest reason was that he couldn't stand to be around the people he would have to work with, which I don't blame him, right? It's that, and this is like part of the problem is that, you know, the system we have does not optimize for excellence. And that's, it turns out that's a problem.
Yeah, well, I went to an event last fall, and it was basically like people getting together trying to say, like, all right, how do we affect change at the federal level? And there was a whole panel about a think tank out of D.C. that's like, we can get the problem that we've had in affecting change is people like your friend who you point at, you're like, you'd be great as a congressman, a senator, like somewhere in the federal government to affect change. And they said the biggest problem is these people get into office, they have rosy eyes, and they have really good intentions, and then they get there and they don't know how to operate within the bureaucracy. So like this whole think tank is like, we're going to train these people how to operate throughout the bureaucracy. And I'm sitting there thinking like, what, like that's the problem, is that this system at the federal level isn't what most Americans think it is, where it's you vote for your congressman, your senator, president, vice president, whatever it may be, and like you think that's who's actually representing you, but this whole administrative bureaucracy layer has been embedded that makes it
right
somewhat impossible to actually affect change.
For the you know, people who got a 4 or 5 on the AP U.S. history exam, they know that structurally we supposedly have 3 branches of government, but there's really 4. Right, the administrative state is nominally a part of the executive branch, but it operates almost autonomously, and that is where, you know, if you think about like the iceberg theory, right? You know, the 3 stated branches are just the tip, mm-hmm. and then the bureaucracy that actually runs everything is the massive iceberg that's below the waterline. You know, Balaji had a post, it's a few years ago now, but he went through. And he counted, I think at the time he said it was probably, he was probably way understating it, but the number of people who had these unaccountable positions with budgets that they exercised discretion over that were $1 billion or more. So basically, you know, these little fiefdoms. And it was like, it was hundreds of people, right? And that you think about where, like, why is government so frustrating? Why is it so inefficient? Why is it not responsive? Well, that's part of your answer, because there's no way to, no easy way, let me say it that way, there's no easy way to affect change upon these mandarins who control these enormous budgets, almost without oversight. You can't fire them. or at least not easily.
You need like a Malay like character to come and say La Fuera and just start ripping it out forcefully. Which is like, do you think they're like it's? Do you think it's possible to do
it's,
something?
Of
like
course,
that?
It's possible. I actually think that it's really a paper tiger. There needs to be somebody who's just willing, who's just willing to push through and do it. All of these. This is like the phrase learned helplessness. Like we've got, that like everybody's been lulled to sleep thinking like, gosh, it's so hard. The problem's so big.
And people have taken too many black pills.
And it's just not true. Like these things can be done because the, among other things, not only just is human agency real, like we have agency and we have the ability to do the things that we want to do. But also remember the people on the other side also have learned helplessness. So they're just sitting there. And if you sort of just force your way through through the problem, you can fix them. But people are always sitting back, and this is where I think this is like my biggest critique of it's like a, and I don't mean this like in a negative way; it's constructive. But people think way too small. Like there's a lot of things that are possible if people understood that they actually really do have agency, and if they just think about again, I always come back to this: like, what's the world you want to live in? What's the country you want to live in? What does that look like? Just go build it. You may not get it exactly right, but you're going to get a hell of a lot further by thinking about the thing you want. Don't negotiate yourself down. Like, I want it like this, but I'll take 20% of that. Like, just figure out what it is you want and go try and get that. And that's really been, like, I know that sounds like almost like too cute a little bit. Like, I feel like it's a little too sweet to say that, but I don't mean it that way because that's actually been the history of this country. Mm-hmm. You've got this book Lone Star, which, I'm obsessed with, but this country was a frontier country. It really imbues the ethos and the personality and the psychology of Americans. Like, you've got, these tiny settlements, like, clinging to the Atlantic coast 400 years ago. Mm-hmm. And, just take, like, the Mayflower settlement, the Mayflower Pilgrims. They knew exactly how they wanted to live. Like, they started off as a congregation in the Midlands of England. They sort of, that didn't work. They emigrated to the Netherlands, got kicked out of the Netherlands, moved back to England, and they're finally like, well, there's some really crappy land, and we're not over on the other side of this water, but we know the way we want to live, and we're just going to go build that. And it turns out they attracted a ton of other people who were thinking sort of different versions of that, Jamestown, or there were settlements in Florida at roughly the same time, and then just push forward, push west. And this is like one of the things that I think has implicitly confused the American psyche for the past like 40 or 50 years is like the frontier closed, basically. Like, we're a frontier country. It's like conquer the continent, build a new country, new society. And then you go from east to west, get to the Pacific, and then it's like fill in time. Then you got to all, like, even in my lifetime, like places like Denver were like very small cities. Like when I was born, I mean, even like into the 80s or 90s, like Denver wasn't that big a deal, right?
It's, I mean, you hear people talk about this city only a decade ago,
right? Yeah. So that's still sort of going on. But when the frontier really closed, a lot of the fill-in got done, and then that sort of coincides with the end of World War II. Mm-hmm. And now it's like, oh, damn, like, what do we do now? Like, what's our huge national project? Because, like, we did it. And that's where, like, that has to sort of morph. I think I think the Cold War filled that role for a while. Mm-hmm. And then it was like after that, and this is where I think we've really gone off the rails. It's like, well, okay. It's like, okay, country founded, check. Continent conquered, check. World War II won, check. Cold War won, check. It's like, now the best thing we could do is like fight stupid, pointless, winless wars, like in the world's shitholes.
Yeah.
Like that's like, we're better than that. We should be figuring out a lot better things to be doing than that.
Yeah. Like, take back our privacy. I mean, like,
that would be nice. Yeah. Right. For starters.
Let's abolish the Bank Secrecy Act, the Patriot Act, and just get back to a point where Like, that would be a great American story, is like, we've gotten to this point where the pendulum swung and civil liberties have been eroded to such a point where the nature of the relationship between the governed and the government has completely flipped from, or maybe not completely flipped, but it's certainly shifted a large degree in favor of the government, where it's not supposed to be that way. And there would be nothing more American than people to wake up and say, you know what, no, this is wrong. We're taking it back. And to your point, that's actually one thing we've been talking about on this show, and I've been talking about on other shows in recent months, is, yeah, many people are black-pilled, need to take the white pill and recognize that even though everything that stands before us is daunting, it may seem like an impossible task, we can do it. Like, we can win.
100%.
And I think people would be surprised at, we see this within Bitcoin, is like, Bitcoin's like, yeah, we're going to replace the dollar as a world reserve currency. And like, we truly believe that. And once you get immersed in an industry or a group of people like that who are working towards a big goal, it's infectious. And I think if that were to extend beyond just the little bubble that I operate within and into other people's minds, and I think people would be surprised with just a few small examples of people doing big things can mm-hmm. lead to engendering a sense of confidence in others. And I think we're beginning to see this with SpaceX, obviously Anduril, many other companies that are out there really pushing the limits in aerospace and defense technology.
So going back to the 1789 Capital, my investment firm, but this is part of our thesis that ESG has really caused a massive misallocation of capital, which is, you know, there's a couple things that spin out of that. One is it's actually quite bad for the country. In our narrow little slice of the world, it's actually great for us because it leads to really good opportunities. And so while we're sitting here talking like, oh, it's like, as people love to do, complaining a little bit about like all these things are wrong, when we're out there investing in these companies, it's actually super encouraging because there are just like some of the greatest founders out there, like smart, driven, just like good people. And they just like, they may not have a vision for what the whole country should be like, nor should they, by the way, like that's like too much for almost anybody. But they have a vision for the thing that they're doing. Mm-hmm. And they're single-minded in it. They're really good at it. I mean, the best ones are anyway. But the point is, there's a lot of really good ones out there. There's, you know, people talk a lot about defense tech. We do a bunch of defense tech. We've made some investments in companies that I really like. And I look at these founders, I'm like these guys are amazing. Like, we should not, like, people should meet them. Like, we should do, like, some type of, I don't know, like a symposium with these guys, because it's like, it is actually inspirational to see what they're doing. And they're not sitting back. Like, people are too obsessed with politics. I think they black pill themselves. Like, they just get paused on their own, like, complaining. And then you go out and see people who are just like, I need to build a better rocket motor. Now, we're invested in a company that does this up in Dallas. And guess what? They did, you know. And we need a better fuel to go in that motor. Did that too. We need a better way to manufacture that fuel. Yep, check. Did that too. Now let's scale it. And there's all kinds of instances of that going on in this country. It actually, so when you say like, there's all these problems, can we fix them? Yeah, because like, there's like, I don't know what percentage of the country who are just like amazing builders.
Yeah.
And those people like need to band together and build.
And not only that, but it's never been easier to build when you think about, I mean, outside of the red tape that can be put in front of you by the government. Like, if you ignore that, which is sometimes hard to ignore for a lot of people, particularly if you're doing something like nuclear reactors or something like that. But
tough in biotech, right? I mean, this is why a lot of people and a lot of money flowed out of, to my point earlier about like, we want people to live longer, healthier lives. Like, there is a healthcare component of that. Really hard to deal with the FDA. Mm-hmm. Time consuming, expensive. They're super risk averse. And so what happened? Money and talent flowed into things like SaaS, mm-hmm. right? So you got more software because like a single guy could just sit there in his room and like, you know, pound Red Bulls and like listen to EDM for 35 hours. and the next thing you knew, he'd build like Instagram or something.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah. And I mean, we see it in Bitcoin. as well, particularly on the financial regulation, whether it's NYDFS or FinCEN or supranational unelected bureaucrats at the Financial Action Task Force putting out all these guidelines that really constrict. But again, stripping all that away, like particularly as it pertains to Bitcoin, like it's an open source protocol with all these other open source tools and developer kits that are being brought to market. Like when you talk about building sci-fi, freedom preserving, money and banking technology, like it's never been easier. Mm-hmm. And it's just waking people up to that. Like, yes, this is daunting. And yes, parts of the government may not like it, but like if we're looking about what's possible, like it has never been easier and more possible than it is today.
Yeah. No, for sure. More people need to be doing.
They really do. How much of this comes, so do you like thinking generationally here? Like I'm a millennial, 33, 10 when 9/11 happened, senior in high school when 2008 happened, young father when COVID happened. So I've had back to back to back, and throughout my life, like, what the hell is going on? 2008 jaded me. That's probably what led me to Bitcoin. And then 2020 completely radicalized me and like, oh, the government is completely off the rocker here. And so what are your thoughts on like younger generations? Are you seeing younger builders come to market and like trying to get a perspective on Gen Z and whether or not they understand the problems that exist, and are they going to be the ones to solve it?
I sure hope so. It's like the generational explanations are like good at like a first approximation, I think. But it always comes back to like it's always like dedicated minorities that change history or that build the things that change history. And I think that's true regardless of these generations. Like you look at the boomers, the worst generation, right? Literally the generation that destroyed this country and continues to do it. But that's a first approximation, right? That's not like every boomer, because there's this way where there's two really distinct subsets of boomers. And the narcissism is pretty broad in the boomer world, which in a way is like just arithmetic. Like there's so many of them, right? That the world actually always did just conform to them. So they just have like that sense of entitlement, but there's like, somebody explained this to me. I wish I had come up with this on my own like 10 years ago before people started with the okay boomer thing, but they explained like there were basically in the 60s there were two types of boomers. Like they're in their teens and 20s right at the time. They're the ones who like were listening to the Beatles, and they're the ones who are listening to Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. And the latter were the traditionalists, right? Mm-hmm. They were just normal people. They wanted to go get a job, have a family. They were like, but nobody talks about them as boomers. They're just like kind of forgotten. And the point is that like the radicals were a minority, and everybody thinks about them as the boomers. But in actuality, they were a small subset of the boomers. They had a vision for how they would destroy the country, and they have executed on that vision pretty well. Because they worked together, they knew what they wanted to do. It was like, if there's any standard of decency, let's tear it down. That was sort of their reason for being.
And they had a long-term vision that they implemented.
Like, they did, and they were working on it a long time. But my point is that it's like, you think about what are the Zoomers going to do? It doesn't take all of them. Like, with the Boomers, it was a small group of them. I'm Gen X. Really, like the forgotten generation, it's like a relatively small generation compared to the millennials or boomers. Like a friend of mine told me like 5, 6, 7 years ago, like super well known, like you would know his name if I said it, but like VC, been very successful, also Gen X. So Gen X is like the late bloomer generation, which I actually think is true, mm-hmm. because the boomers won't move on, right? Like they're going to die in their CEO seats or whatever. He's not a technically boomer, but like look at Biden. Mm-hmm. But like, so Gen X sort of comes into its own like later in life, probably like late 40s and 50s. And then there's like millennials and Gen Z. But I guess just to come back to the direct point, it's going to be like a faithful remnant in each one of these generations that is going to figure out how to work with the faithful remnant in every other generation and, like, you know, and just basically build the better country and to hell with everybody else. Like, don't even worry about what they're doing. Just overcome, build.
Yeah. And that's, it's funny you mentioned the remnant. That's, I mean, Mises has, what is it, Isaiah wrote the story of the remnant. And that floated around Bitcoin a while ago. That's what a lot of Bitcoiners gravitated towards, that piece and that that view of what it's going to take to win. Just don't worry about the brainwashed masses. Just find the remnant. And that's one thing, I think, as it sits today, particularly in 2024, again, post-COVID, I think, I was talking about this with somebody else a few weeks ago, but I feel like a bunch of people in many different verticals basically went into the foxhole and like, how did it get this bad? And they've all since popped their head up and like, all right, I know my vertical. I know how Fauci and crew like covered it up. Others are, you had the GameStop crew and Wall Street Bets, Bitcoiners obviously doing their thing, defense tech guys being like, all right, like there needs to be disruption here. And now I think we're at the point now, and I think independent media is really helping to make this happen, which is all these different groups that are looking for the remnant in their own vertical need to like pop their head up and like look at each other like, hey, we may be able to help each other out. And
totally.
I've seen this most particularly between Bitcoin and energy.
That's interesting.
Because of the Bitcoin mining.
It's a natural alliance, but
And so there was a time in like 2021, 2022, particularly oil and gas firms who I dealt with a lot because of the nature of the company that we were running. But basically like the ESG completely, I don't want to say emasculated, but there's a lot of people like in oil and gas, particularly the bigger companies, have sort of bent the knee to ESG and like, oh, we're going to help you transition. And I went in, I was like, no, like energy's good.
I would say a good rule of thumb in life in the 2020s, if somebody says I'm going to help you transition, just say no.
Hey, you may wake up without a deck or tent, so you gotta be careful there.
It's like just Edward Scissorhands, stop right where you are.
But it's, and I think, I don't want to say it was all Bitcoin, but I do think like some of the conversations we had were like confidence inducing for the year. Like I had to shake some oil and gas people up, like slap them, like stop putting up with this bullshit. Like,
totally.
Give us, like, we're going to work together. Bitcoin mining will help make you as efficient as possible. You'll monetize all your wasted and stranded resources. Not all of them, but we'll start monetizing these wasted resources. We'll make you more efficient. And don't bend the knee. You're providing probably arguably the most needed service to the economy, which is reliable, cheap energy.
Yeah.
And we would not be where we are without hydrocarbons. So stop saying sorry for producing oil and gas.
Like sorry for producing all this wealth, safety, prosperity, and security for everybody. Like, no.
Yeah.
Like the, there's, my wife's from Michigan, and like the conceit in Detroit, which is partially true, is that like Detroit was like the arsenal of democracy that won World War II. There's enough truth in it to we'll give it to the Detroiters. Like, you know, like Chrysler was just like rolling tanks off, like Sherman tanks off the line, like every 5 seconds or whatever. And there's truth to that. But, you know, I think actually the thing that in a way is it's equally true, if not more true, is that like Texas oil is what not only won World War II, but actually produced all of the prosperity afterwards because it was abundant and it was cheap. And a cheap, abundant energy is the key to prosperity. Which is going back to what you were saying earlier about like nuclear, like whoever has the abundant source of low cost energy among the major powers on the planet will win. Yeah. Period.
No, it's triggered. And this is why I've been on an ESG vendetta for years, because you look at the LARP, like we're going to get to net zero 2030. It's like, number one, that's impossible. Number two, I don't think carbon dioxide is pollutant. I don't think there's a climate crisis. Like, I don't think we need to pause the global economy to save ourselves from the weather. And despite everybody's well intent to go to net zero, even though I think it's psychotic, it doesn't matter. India, China, the Middle East now. They're all going to spin up. I mean, China's spun up more coal plants in the last 5 years than I think exist in the the U.S. alone. They're spinning up nuclear, and yet we're just completely constricting ourselves here, not even just in the United States, in the West more broadly. And it's not even a Pyrrhic victory, it's a total loss. We're going to get completely leapfrogged if we keep on this energy policy trajectory.
There's, you know, I've just been thinking about, like, on a related topic, I've been thinking about this. I'm not sure what the answer is, but, like, some of these, like, sort of idiotic decisions that our country makes around energy, for example, or, like, in COVID, just, like, the extreme, like, sociopathic risk aversion. Like one possible explanation is it's a consequence of an aging society. Like median age in 1970 was like 27 years old or something like that. And right now it's like 37 or 38 in this country. Like, so, okay, like older people just by, you know, naturally become more risk averse over time. But China has a higher median age than we do by like 2.5 years. But they seem less risk averse, so maybe that answer seems appealing, but maybe it's wrong, or maybe it's a combination of the risk aversion that comes with age, with I don't know, like there's like a disease of affluence or something.
I think it's complex
answer.
Yeah, I lean more towards like virtue signaling, like we rest on our laurels, and if you look at, I mean, where we stand today, and you like juxtapose it to empires that have risen and fallen in the past, like the analogs are all there. You go back to ancient Rome, spread the empire globally, completely debased their currency, the denarius, and it got to the point where they had expanded their military and debased their currency so much that people in the military were like, this isn't money, like we're done, we're not working for you. Barbarians come and sack Rome. Fast forward, Weimar Republic has to pay back their debts for World War One. They start printing marks. At the same time, they have this crazy socially liberal demographic that is trying to erode the social fabric within, and they debase the currency and debase their society, and boom, hyperinflation, collapse of Weimar Germany. And it just seems we're getting there too. And you know, obviously with the amount of debt, the amount of money we've printed, and then you just look at the health statistics alone are just like literally fat and getting dumber by the day. It just seems like
the reversal of the Flynn effect. Yeah. It's crazy. And it's like the Flynn effect was like the, like basically broad based rise in IQ. And then it reversed sometime maybe 15 or 20 years ago, but not just here. Right. It's also happened in Western Europe too. There's something about postmodern life that seems like anti-life, that's sort of like dysgenic.
That's Malthusian.
Yeah. Like people are getting like fatter, dumber, living longer, you know, or living shorter lives, more lethargic, more depressed. Mm-hmm. There's a scientist in the 50s and 60s named John Calhoun, not the South Carolina senator, you know, not theirs, I guess, rep. But he did this series of studies on Warsaw rats where he wanted to see the effects of basically overcrowding. He was trying to like simulate high density urban, like modern urban life. And so when you put these Warsaw rats into these high density environments, they get all of these pathologies they overeat, they become really lethargic, they stop reproducing, they become like occasionally like weirdly violent, they eat their young, like, and it's been, by the way, this study has been reproduced, like there's not a replication crisis with this study. It's like, well, that sounds a lot like San Francisco or, you know, or New York, right? Yeah. And this was 1960-ish. So there's like, I don't know, there's something going on that like, I feel like we just have like a glimpse into what the problem is. But if you do the overlay, like the county overlay of fertility rates, they're not really great any place in this country. Mm-hmm. Utah, they're decent. Shocker, yeah. I know. Yeah. Like, there's some places in rural Texas where they're decent, but they're always, they're basically the worst always in high-density urban environments. And it's like you can drill down, not just at county level, you can drill it down to, like, zip code levels, too. So it's like it's sort of, it doesn't entirely cut across income, but, you know, it affects all incomes.
Yeah.
Except the very highest, by the way. Mm-hmm. Like, if it's super high income, this is like the other thing. Super high incomes tend to still have like intact families or relative to the median and be having a decent number of kids.
Yeah, you know, that's, I mean, talk to millennials. Like I'm lucky I have two boys and plan to have more children, but a lot of people my age, they don't think they have the economic opportunity to.
Is that why? Is that the answer?
It's like a lot of the time.
Can't afford a house or can't afford the expenses that go along with it.
Which I think is actually dumb, because what I found when I had my first son was like I was more motivated than ever to go make some money. So it's a bit counterintuitive. It's like, oh, they're going to be expensive. It's like, I think you'll be surprised at how motivated you become once you have a child. But yeah.
Many men have found this over time.
Yeah.
We've got a friend we do some business with. He's like roughly your age. Just found out he was expecting, like, maybe, well, he's probably actually the baby's due pretty soon. Always good. Like, this, you want to talk about somebody who is, like, on the job now, like, super laser focused. It's amazing what a focusing effect it has on you.
Yeah. And then once they're here, too, it's like, holy crap. Like,
yeah,
you need to live a good life. So daddy's got to go work harder.
I mean, yeah.
No, it is. Yeah, there's a lot of distractions, too. And then the job market's absolute shit as well, despite what the Biden administration would have you believe. There's a lot of
I've been led to believe it's never been better.
Yeah, it's never been better, and the AI.
And there's no inflation either.
Yeah, we've solved inflation.
They passed the Inflation Reduction Act, Marty, yes. So now everything's fine.
Yeah, you just solve inflation by giving out a bunch of subsidies and crippling our reliable energy infrastructure. That's the way to go.
By the way, on the flare gas thing, meant to make this point. Have you ever been to Midland?
I have not yet.
I flew into Midland for the first time about like maybe 8 months ago, and the flight came in at night. And it is, you'll appreciate this just because you use flare gas, but when you're flying in at night, for the last like maybe 10 minutes, you're flying over West Texas and coming into the airport, just as far as the eye can see, you just see flare gas every place.
An orange hue.
I found it totally inspiring. It's like, see what you can do, see what you can build, see what you can find in the earth that can make life better.
Yeah, and I see that, and I see Bitcoin. I'm like, all right, how many gen sets can we get? Like, how many data centers can we get and plug it in?
You see, just see like orange BTCs out there in the Permian?
No, because we operated predominantly in the Bakken in North Dakota, and we had some really cool videos of when we would set a site up and then initially turn it on, and they'd literally divert the gas from the flare to the gen set that would power the Bitcoin mine, and you could visibly see the flare go off and the mine turn on. It's just like you were literally burning,
that's cool,
burning a resource, and now you're still burning it but monetizing it and not having to pay EPA fines. And flare gas is very, very small amount of overall network hash rate. But I think, again, if people are motivated enough and are allowed to, like, we could be as energy efficient as we want to, upstream, downstream, on grid, off grid.
Mm-hmm.
My personal miners, one thing I want to do is solve the stranded gas well problem that exists, particularly in Appalachia, where you have the shallow oil basin. They truck the oil out over the course of a couple years, 3 years, never built pipelines for the natural gas to get to midstream, and you have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of wells spread all throughout Appalachia, producing on the back end of their decline curves, producing like 21 MCFD. That small amount of gas is enough to power probably like 40 Bitcoin miners right now.
No kidding.
And the stranded well problem is a big one. You have these unmaintained wells just leaking methane and getting into water sources. There's no economic incentive outside of subsidies to try to maintain those wells. And now with Bitcoin, we have pure economic incentive to solve it because you monetize it on site.
What's the sort of what's the inhibitor from doing that?
Yeah, it's a logistics problem if you have multiple of them scattered. But I think if you solve that logistics problem, which I think is very solvable, there's no reason that we shouldn't be tapping these stranded wells and mining Bitcoin with them. Then you have supply chain, not necessarily supply chain issues, but if oil and gas is going up, demand for generators in the field goes up, prices for generators goes up. So you have to sort of time. We probably need to expand the generation production to make it make sense at scale, but it's there. There is a solution to it. Just trying to figure it out. Yeah, we can solve all these problems.
We can do it. Yeah. See, just everybody's got to pick their lane and just fix what they can fix, build what they can build.
Yeah, I'll have to show you a video of the operation we have going up in Tennessee. It's really cool. It's been fascinating.
It's been great. Thank you for having me.
Last minute. Any words of advice? Final thoughts for anybody listening to this?
I will. There's this conference. I don't know when this episode will drop, but there's a conference going on in Detroit called Reindustrialize, and I've got a sort of still drafting my talk for the group up there. But you know the EAC thing online.
Mm-hmm.
And my the title of my talk is going to be Acceleration is Not Enough. And
hyper acceleration.
Yeah, like this is like a constant theme. I just keep thinking people just are thinking too small. Mm-hmm. Like whatever, you know, we think about I see your bookshelf here. Like obviously a student of history. Like we have to like regain our sense of agency and of purpose, and then just raise our sights by like at least an order of magnitude, because the things that people are doing, even the people who are doing really good stuff, often are just not big enough. They're capable of a lot more, but have been so lulled to sleep by, you know, whether they blackpill themselves or it's kind of like the Warsaw Rat thing. They're like in these dense environments, and so they're like their vitality is somehow being drained out of them. Just get it back and do it, because there's just so much that can be done. And when people realize what they're capable of, then they realize that it's actually way more than they thought.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's my word of advice. Just build.
Yeah, build. And on reindustrialization, did you see Thomas Massie coming out after that GOP meeting thinking that...
What did he say?
He said that Trump in the meeting floated like eliminating income tax and increasing tariffs, which I think...
I did see this.
Yeah. Which I think is a very smart way if you want to reindustrialize.
Maybe this is my final thought. If in the Bible God only wants a tithe, 1 in 10, why does the government get to have more?
Yeah, why do they get to have 50, 40, whatever it is?
Yeah,
now?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Seems like a heresy.
We'll end on heresy. Chris, thank you. Peace and love, freaks.